ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Greetings, and thank you for joining us on ID, the Future. I'm Tom Gilson. In this episode, we hear the conclusion of an extensive conversation between Dr. Stephen Meyer, who leads the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, and Dr. Brian Keating, who is the Chancellor's Distinguished Professor of Physics at the University of California at San Diego. Dr. Keating is also the author of the book Losing the Nobel Prize, A Story of Cosmology, Ambition, and the Perils of Science's Highest Honor. He hosted this conversation on his podcast titled Into the Impossible, which you can also find by searching Dr. Brian Keating on YouTube or from his website at briankeating.com. The topic of their discussion is Stephen Meyer's book, Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. Let's listen in now to their final half hour together.
Is it a valid argument to say that an absence of understanding of how a deity could instantiate these processes is a strike against the God hypothesis in the following sense? So let's stipulate that the universe began either, you know, in a finely, you know, tuned initial condition in the inflationary cosmology or in the cyclical episodic cosmologies of Penrose, of Steinhardt, of Turok, and many others. Let's just stipulate the universe emerges in the, with the proper, you know, characteristics. And then the universe is kind of a boring place for hundreds of thousands of years. And even at that time when my bread was buttered, so to speak, when the cosmic microwave background is produced, the formation of hydrogen, still not much happens for another 400 million years when galaxies begin to form. And then you know, there is a surfeit of galaxies in the observable universe. We have no evidence for life or anything in any other planet in our solar system, let alone in other solar systems in our galaxy, let alone in other galaxies in the current time in our present universe, let alone in the past or the future of our current observable universe. But let's just say the universe is pretty boring. And then if you're just kind of, as I like to do, let's talk about me, just focus on the Earth. Nothing much happens. The Earth, you know, coalesces out of a protoplanetary disk, a bunch of dust comes together, billions of years go by, and then all of a sudden, you know, some molecules come out of the primordial soup, with information. I'll even stipulate there's information there that was cellular digital information in the form of the genetic code. All this playing out by the laws of physics, which you argue are very finely tuned. I should point out there's a colleague, my good colleague, Fred Adams at the University of Michigan, who claims that the evidence for fine tuning in cosmology is not quite as stringent as made out. And we'll talk about that some other time, because I think it's a detail, especially as it pertains to this rambling question that I'm asking. So the universe is pretty darn boring for about 9 billion years until the Earth forms. Then the Earth forms, and again, if we're the pinnacle of creation, if we are the planet which, as you believe, will host the Messiah, I believe the Messiah, you believe he'll come back. I believe he's yet to come, but those
come
are theological.
First time, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. You know, we could ask him when he comes, as Avi Loeb, my friend, quoting Elie Wiesel, has said, when he comes, we'll ask him, is this your second time or your first? And then we'll finally know.
We'll sort it out.
So this is the pinnacle of creation. How does God interact in your view as a philosopher, et cetera? Very, very, by the way, to the audience out there, I might be rambling, but the book is not. The book is as deep in cosmology. I mean, we're talking about Wick rotations, complex planes, Cauchy integrals, and then is equally kind of fluid and maybe even more so conversant with the biological implications, because that was your domain expertise in graduate school. But anyway, God is kind of patient, right? And he's waiting. And then all of a sudden the code becomes active. And then we've only had civilization for the past few hundred thousand years. I don't think you deny evolution, obviously, but you believe it's directed by a mind. And even the laws of physics are tuned, and that requires a mind to tune. But I want to ask you, how does the deity interact? In other words, he was fine-tuning 14 billion years ago nearly, but the pinnacle of what he's waiting for comes about in the last 100,000 years. So round up. These are big numbers. It's basically the entirety of the universe. For the laws to actually matter, in other words, you know, forget about dinosaurs. I don't really care about that. If we are the pinnacle, we're the only entity with mind that is conscious as Homo sapiens, means we are conscious of our existence and that we are existing. Therefore, we know we're going to die. And we're the only animals. Yeah. We're the only creatures that can do that. So we're the pinnacle. Why would God do it in this way? You know, why, how would he do it? Because I think it's fair to ask how. You know, is he in a laboratory? Is he experimenting? If so, you know, how does it get instantiated, the mind? Is it just like this roll of the dice? It came up so finely tuned because he's omniscient, omnipotent, and everything else that he knew eventually there'd be a you and me in a Zoom call that we could chat on. In other words, how is the mind able to account
affect
for
matter?
Yeah, for the teleological purpose that we should exist.
Let me speak first about the time question, because I have you know, friends to my right, if you will, who are hold to a young Earth creationist view, and they're often troubled by the great amounts of time that have elapsed from the beginning of the universe to the first appearance of life on Earth. And I think you could ask that question coming from the opposite perspective. But to me, I think the great expanse of space and the great expanse of time that you know, we have lots of galaxies that don't seem to give any evidence of life, lots of planets that don't seem to have the right conditions. Our planet does seem to be very privileged, as one of my colleagues put it in the book Privileged Planet. But to me, it speaks of a kind of divine extravagance, that, you know, the whole great big universe with 13.8 billion years of time that preceded us was leading up to a teleological endpoint. So I don't find that the amount of time that's transpired from the beginning till the appearance of life on Earth troubling. But there's there were concepts, theological concepts, that existed prior to any of this discussion that I think were helpful, and they were part of the scientific revolution. The idea that there were two powers of God that were relevant to understanding nature. One was called the potentia ordinata, the ordinary power of God, which was posited as the explanation for the regularities that we see in nature, that God's hand was for the most part hidden in that, but yet God was behind the regularities. What we call the laws of nature, are a mode of divine action. And then theologians also spoke of something they called the potentia absoluta, or the fiat power of God, where God was capable on occasion of acting as an agent within the orderly concourse of nature that he otherwise sustained and upheld. And so I think we have evidence of both powers of God in our physical cosmos, and certainly the fine tuning of the initial conditions of the universe. And there, I know about Fred Adams, and I also know, if you've looked at the book Fortunate Universe by Luke Barnes and his Cambridge grad supervisor, whose name is slipping my mind.
Jarrett Lewis, yeah, they were guests on
Lewis, yeah. And they've, you know, the terrific pairing there with a theist and a materialist discussing the fine tuning. But they argue that that Adams's position is really an outlier. And they, at the end of the book, say, whether you're a materialist or you're a theist, here's a great list of fantastic physicists who all see the fine tuning was a real thing. And it has to be explained one way or another, whether by a multiverse or by theistic design, whether by many universes or one God. But in any case, the point is, I think in the fine tuning, and for me, in the origin of life and the origin of the digital code, I think we see evidence of discrete intelligent action. Everything we know from experience shows that information, especially in a digital or alphabetic form, and that's what we find at the foundation of life in DNA and RNA. I mean, this is a stop press moment in the history of biology, that when we discover that, you know, the secret to heredity, the secret to how proteins are built, is actually a complex information storage, transmission, and processing system that's run by literally digital code that is being expressed in accord with an independent symbol convention that we now call the genetic code. This is an extraordinary discovery.
And yet every day, men and women get together and do it for free.
Yeah. Well, exactly. So, you know, where did the information come from? That problem has stymied origin of life research. This is what I did my PhD on. It's what the book Signature in the Cell was all about. Even new atheists as prominent as Richard Dawkins have acknowledged that we have no idea from an evolutionary point of view how life first originated from simple non-living chemicals.
Although, as Darwin himself pointed out, you know this better than anybody, but he said it's no objection to speak of the origin of life as not being understood within the theory of evolution. One might as well criticize the origin of matter. And I'd like to point out, we understand the origin of matter now, but is that a God of the gaps argument type of argument?
I think on Darwin's part, it's more a materialism of the gaps. He's saying, well, we don't understand the origin of matter, so why should we have to come up with an explanation for the origin of life? In fact, we don't understand the origin. We still don't understand the origin of either from a materialistic point of view. But as for the origin of information, we have a wealth of experience as to what causes information to arise. The great information theorist Henry Quassler, who was one of the first information theorists to apply the information sciences to an analysis of molecular biology, says that in our experience, he says, information habitually rises from conscious activity. And we know this from, and this is part of what we know and should be helping to inform us as we think about the origin of information in a biological context. Whenever we see information, whether it's in computer code or in a hieroglyphic inscription or a paragraph in a book, or information that's embedded in a radio signal, and we trace it back to its source, we always come to a mind, not a material process. So when the discovery of information at the foundation of life in every living cell, including the very simplest ones, I think is evidence of the activity of a mind, of an intelligence. And in fact, it's this connection between information and intelligence is presupposed in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. They're looking for information embedded in radio signals, and if they find it, they're going to conclude that it has an intelligent source from another galaxy or planet or something. So, I think, to get back to the broader question you asked, I think we have evidence of discrete divine action at the beginning of the universe, and very possibly after that, especially with the origin of the information necessary to get life going in the first place.
Yeah, and you see this also, I won't belabor the point, but the simulation hypothesis is also a presupposition, which I think ultimately, you know,
it's a design theory. It's a design theory.
And it brings up all sorts of interesting, you know, theological questions of theodicy of the simulators, you know, would they create evil? But again, you know, I've had this argument from the left, I don't know how to say it, with Sean Carroll, you know, who said that, you know, God is not a good theory. So I've asked him point blank, you know, what are the odds that the multiverse is a true explanation for the origin of the laws of nature in our physical universe? And he says 50-50. I say, what are the odds of God's existence? And he says less than 1%. So he won't rule it out, obviously. But he'll say things like, well, can you envision a simpler universe? Can you envision a simpler universe that could exist via Occam's razor, if you like, which I often point out, you know, is more like a hatchet than a razor, as employed by most people. But nevertheless, having you know, a simpler universe, he would posit, you know, an empty Hilbert space. To which I'll say, well, who creates the Hilbert space? And, you know, and he really doesn't have a good example. You know, he'll say things, oh, come on, you know, where does that come? But it is true. They're you know, I think the, and he's I would say, he I would say is not, you know, is a pacifist atheist, in that he's not interested in converting people to atheism as Dawkins or Krauss might openly suggest they are. And yet he'll say things like, well, what is the purpose of the Hubble Deep Field galaxy, you know, 65,252 over there on the left, you know, the cosmic wallpaper, as we call it. What's the purpose of that galaxy? What's the purpose of you know, the 40th excited state of xenon? What is the purpose of CP violation in cobalt 60? You know, why do these things exist? Is it, you know, God just having fun? I mean, extravagance is one thing, but, you know, as we know, there's no information without energy. There's no creation of order, you know, without destruction, reduction of entropy. And that requires energy. So, you know, is it just the profligacy? Is it God showing off? You mentioned before, it's sort of like almost like a flourish, the magnificence of it all. But it would seem very profligate. And so what is it? Or I think you might answer, but I should let you answer, but we don't know. In other words, we can't know why God would do it. But what would be the purpose of wasting? I mean, it's like lawns in the Western Hemisphere were created, you know, by as a byproduct of royalty, demonstrating that they didn't need to use their agricultural resources to grow food. It was meant to show resplendent abundance in their creation. So what is the purpose of Cobalt 60's parity violation? What is the purpose of Xenon's 40th resonance? What is the purpose of that galaxy over there? In a universe with a mind, it would seem quite wasteful.
Well, our approach is not to try to assign a purpose to everything that we see in the nature, but rather to detect action of intelligence where the evidence, the distinctive hallmarks of intelligence are present. As to the rest, maybe it is cosmic wallpaper, but the Hubble Deep Field's an awfully beautiful piece of wallpaper. I mean, it's really, you know, so.
Yeah, I pointed out to Sean, I have a colleague who studies that galaxy over there.
I have a PowerPoint I do on your field, on cosmology. I have a beautiful picture of the Hubble Deep Field. I think it's gorgeous, you know. There is extravagant beauty in the universe. My work, the work of other people who work on intelligent design, is not trying to assign a purpose to every last piece of the universe, but rather to detect activity of intelligence where it is to be found. And I think it is certainly found in the origin of life. It's certainly found in the fine tuning. It's certainly found, I think, at the beginning of the universe. So rather than say, how did God do it in that sense, we're trying to detect that there was a mind behind it. And then in this book, what I do is ask the question, well, what is the most likely identity of the designing mind that is revealed by these features of the universe that display distinctive hallmarks of mind? And that's where I say, I don't think it's a space alien. I don't think it's even just a deistic creator. When you look at Dawkins, actually, in a film several years ago, was interviewed by Ben Stein, and he said, Ben Stein asked him about the problem of the origin of the first life, and Dawkins acknowledged that there isn't an adequate materialistic evolutionary explanation for same. And he said, you know, it might be that there's a signature of, this is Dawkins speaking, there might be that there's a signature of intelligence in the cell, in which case it would have had to have come from another, an alien intelligence that itself was evolled by undirected
that's the
natural
panspermia. Right.
Yeah, panspermia idea. That's unsatisfying in this in two respects, and I argue against this in the book. Let's take it seriously as a metaphysical hypothesis. First, it pushes the question of the ultimate origin back one generation out into space without answering it, and it leaves it unanswered. Whereas the theory of intelligent design posits the only cause does generate information, and that is mind. But secondly, any intelligence within the cosmos cannot account for the evidence of design that precedes it in the fine tuning of the laws and constants of physics and the initial conditions of the universe. That evidence of design points in a transcendent direction, something beyond the universe, or to a transcendent multiverse. But I have reasons that I lay out in the book for preferring a theistic design hypothesis as an explanation for the fine tuning over and against the multiverse, in particular, that the multiverse requires universe-generating mechanisms, which themselves require prior unexplained fine-tuning. So the fine-tuning never gets ultimately explained by the multiverse hypothesis, and yet there is one type of explanation that accounts for finely tuned systems in our experience, whether they're French recipes or exquisitely crafted pieces of machinery or digital code, and that is, again, what we mean by fine-tuning is a small probability system that achieves an overall function, a discernible function. And when those two things are conjoined, we talk about that as fine tuning. And we also know in experience that those types of systems arise from mind. So I think, I think there are reasons to prefer theistic design over the multiverse. I don't think it's 50-50 for one and zero for the other. I think there's reasons to prefer one over the other.
Well, to be fair to Sean, he said 1% or less. So he didn't quite say zero. He's too smart to say zero, right?
To be fair to Sean Carroll, for another reason, I very much appreciate his work because unlike some of the really ardent defenders of scientific materialism who take it as axiomatic and take anyone who disagrees as ignoble and ill-informed, Carroll is very clear that scientific naturalism or materialism is itself a metaphysical hypothesis. It's a worldview that needs to be defended. And I appreciate him for that reason, because he puts it on the table and says, all right, let's look at it. What's the evidence for and against? And he makes a case. And with such a person, you can have a very constructive conversation.
Yeah, he's a genuine intellectual and somebody that I have great respect for. He's also a phenomenal scientist and mentor, and he endorsed my book, so I can't say anything.
So you can only say good things, and you gave me a nice endorsement. So
Although with endorsements, endorsements are kind of funny because of the zero sum nature of reading books. Yeah, I can't read your book and read my book, or a customer can't. You know, so it's kind of dangerous, right? You don't want to be too glowing in the praise of another's work. No, your book is really phenomenal. As I say, you may not agree with everything, but you'll have your work cut out for you. And for me, you come away sharpened for the better from this debate. I want to push back a little bit on the mind and the code. Anyone who's ever been to the DMV and picked up a license plate, you know, I picked up a license plate the other day for my wife's car getting renewal, 6ZQ, TXY4. Wow, that's really improbable. I mean, to find that, that license plate is extremely improbable. You know, one in a billion chance, of trillions of chances, actually, with all the letter combinations it could be. And yet I got that very one. And obviously there's no mind, behind that. It might have been a random number generator. And of course, random processes can be created randomly, truly, by the radioactive decay, which doesn't require a mind unless you want to go to really prima facie causes. But let's just restrict it to naturalistic explanation. And yet there's no real design. Yes, maybe didn't have a 1,000-letter sequence, but it wasn't but it wasn't really wasteful. It wasn't using, hieroglyphics. It wasn't, just demonstrating the power of the mind. So I want to ask you, at some level, do you think it's possible to derive not just a non-deistic God, but a personal Judeo-Christian God from these arguments that you make in this book, or from intelligent design generally speaking, that advocate for a single God? As atheists will say, is an acute kind of tried and true way, they'll say, I'm not only a monotheist, I actually believe in even fewer gods than you, Stephen. I believe in no gods. So in the sense, can intelligent design follow down a path that will lead to a personal God, in the sense of God who cares about of perhaps interacting with the laws of nature? Maybe not for Brian Keating, but for Jesus Christ, in your opinion, and so forth. A God who intervenes personally to achieve a set of goals or commandments, as in the Ten Commandments that we adhere to. Can you get from ID to, AD in a direct path? Or is it as difficult as proving God's existence to be real?
Well, there's actually two questions in your questions. So let me take the first one about the detection of design, the detection of false positives with design, design inference. The work that my colleague William Dembski has done in his book, The Design Inference, shows that, it's absolutely possible to get a few letters or a few things to arise that look as though they're designed. And the question is, do you have the probabilistic resources to explain such things by chance? And often you do. But there also becomes points where you're beyond the reach of chance. And this has been widely recognized by Origin of Life researchers themselves. There's a great quote from the Scottish biochemist Karen Smith, where he says, you can easily by chance generate a few short words, cat, ran. I used to do this with my students, reach in the Scrabble bag and pick out letters, and occasionally they would, in a demonstration in class, they'd get the word cat or ran or something like that. But I was attempting to show that chance is not an adequate explanation for the origin of the amount of information you would need to build one protein, let alone a full living cell. And so I would always win the argument in the demonstration by continuing to allow them to pull letters out, because as Karen Smith pointed out, if you need a vast amount of information, as the amount of organization or information required increases, chance becomes increasingly implausible. And Dembski has shown that there's an absolute cutoff where you exceed what he calls the probabilistic resources of the universe. And so in both Signature in the Cell, and I reprise this argument a bit in Return of the God Hypothesis, I show that there's actually some sophisticated second-order probabilistic reasoning that allows you to eliminate the chance hypothesis. If you have a very highly specified thing that you're seeking through a random search, and you're only able to sample a small, minuscule proportion of the total, in this case, sequences that are relevant in the time available since the beginning of the universe till now, counting every interaction of elementary particles as an event, you can show that there aren't enough events since the beginning of the universe to sample more than, in the calculation I made, more than 1/10 trillion trillionth of the total relevant sequences in searching for one modest protein. In that case, you can eliminate the chance hypothesis. It's more likely than not the chance will be false. It's overwhelmingly more likely than not that a random search will fail, in which case it's overwhelmingly more likely that the chance hypothesis is false than true. So there are ways of guarding against the kind of false positive inferences to design that you were just describing with the license plate illustration. As to the second question of how you get from an inference to design simpliciter or to a generic intelligence, which is as far as I take the argument in my first two books, in Darwin's Doubt and Signature in the Cell, how you get from a generic designer to a designer that has the attributes of a god that would be recognizable to theists. Well, that is the argument of the new book. And what I do there is broaden the using the method of inference to the best explanation or multiple competing hypotheses that I described earlier in our discussion. I broaden the ensemble of relevant evidence from just the biological evidence, the evidence of design we have long after the beginning of the universe, to look at the evidence that we have either from the beginning of the universe or soon after as the laws of physical chemistry are taking shape, and showing that you have evidence of design prior to the origin of any possible imminent intelligence. No space alien could be responsible for the fine-tuning of the initial conditions of the universe or the laws and constants of physics upon which its very existence depends. And so that candidate designer isn't very good, in which case you're looking at something that is pointing beyond the universe. And then I think you start to look at evidence for transcendent intelligence. But also we have evidence of design long after the beginning. So I think when you take the ensemble of evidences jointly, you have evidence for both an active intelligence, but one which is transcendent. And those two attributes jointly, I think, give you attributes that we uniquely associate with the deity.
Oh, that's fascinating. Stephen, you know, I love talking to you. I could talk to you all day. I would be upbraided and possibly physically abused by many people more intelligent than me, aka my wife, if I don't go and pick up one of my children.
You got to pick up some kids.
Yeah, that's right. But I do want to put a pin in some of these conversations, because I do think it would be great to have more debates or discussions with you about these ultimate issues in life and existence. I think there's so much fun. I think when you take out the hostility of the militant atheist and you do so with love and with true interest in understanding the other's point of view, I find your work fascinating. Again, as I said in my blurb, you might not agree with everything, but the point being, these are the issues that make life worth thinking about and living and understanding. Because not just in the Pascal's wager sense of things, I think that if you don't examine these things, it's sort of you're not making use of the full computational power. It's like buying an iPhone and, oh, it has a camera. I don't need that. Oh, it can browse the internet. I'm just having it, you know, I just have it for the notes app. But Stephen, I love talking with you. I love meeting you in person about 3 weeks ago. But now I want to ask you if you are willing to go into the impossible and answer the final three questions that I ask all my treasured guests who come on the Into the Impossible podcast. And to hear Stephen's answer, I learned this trick from our mutual friend, Ben Shapiro. To hear Stephen's answer, you're going to need to subscribe to my mailing list, which you get at briankeating.com. Stephen is a subscriber, as are many of my guests. So by the way, if you want to be in great company with the wonderful, brilliant 9 Nobel Prize winners who have been on the show, billionaires, brainiacs, ordinary people like you and me, please subscribe, briankeating.com, and you'll get a link to the answers that Stephen will provide to the thrilling three. So if you're not going to listen to that or subscribe, signing off, enjoy the rest of the universe. But for now, those subscribers, now stay tuned for Stephen's answers to the thrilling three. You can get a link to it down here or to my mailing list right there. Stephen, I want to thank you so much for going into the impossible. I wish you the success and blessing and happiness that you are so richly deserving of. And I hope we'll meet again for more of these stimulating impossible conversations. And I hope it won't take 14 billion years of evolution and design for us to come together again.
Fantastic. These conversations are often impossible because of that underlying hostility that we talked about between different groups. But I think we've made it possible this morning, thanks to your great question. So thanks for having me on.
That was Dr. Brian Keating, Chancellor's Distinguished Professor of Physics at the University of California at San Diego, talking with Dr. Stephen Meyer about Meyer's new book, Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. Their conversation originally aired on Dr. Keating's Into the Impossible podcast. You can hear more from Dr. Keating via audio or video by visiting briankeating.com and clicking on podcasts. Consider joining his mailing list there as well. And for more stimulating conversations on evolution and intelligent design, be sure to follow ID the Future on your favorite podcast app, or else find us on the web at idthefuture.com. For ID the Future, this has been Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.